Welcome to Jazz Fest 35, chronicles of the 35-year history of the Syracuse Jazz Fest. I'm Joe Lee, along with Jazz Fest founding director Frank Malfitano, and today we reflect on the Long Branch years, 1987 to 1990. If 1982 to 86 were the toddler years, then 87 to 90 must have been the grade school years for Jazz Fest, the stage where you try to help your child develop a positive self-image. Frank, you had a few years under your belt by now. What's Jazz Fest image at this point in the community?
Well, Joe, we didn't have a lot of sponsorship support. I think back then our sponsorship total was about $2,000, and I think we had about 2,000 to 3,000 attendees, and it seemed like a really comfortable crowd. So we were really a best-kept secret at that point. We wanted to grow, but there was no way we could grow. The site wouldn't allow for that, and we couldn't attract the sponsorship support that we needed to grow the festival further and make it free. So we stayed there as a paid admission one-day festival for a number of years, right up until 1990. And we did the best we could with the resources that we had. We certainly got rained out a lot. We had a lot of monsoon fests. It was a season of monsoons. It seemed like every time we scheduled a jazz fest, there was a monsoon.
These were June, July?
These were June, July, August. Yeah, there was never any set date. We really weren't committed to a certain time frame. It was when the artists were available. And we've kind of come full circle on that, which we'll get into at another point. But back then, we took what we could get when we could get it and hoped for the best weatherwise.
So if Jazz Fest was your child, what was it back then? Was it a troublemaker, a future leader of America, a studious child?
No, I loved it. I loved every second of it. I just the honor to be able to present these incredible American heritage music artists, you know, these great legends and practitioners of the art form. I mean, this was dream come true territory for me. I couldn't believe that in this beautiful setting, in this little sylvan setting amongst the trees, you know, here we had a little stage on a stream and this incredible music wafting through the air, you know? I mean, it was absolutely wonderful. It was magical.
So that's a six-year run at Long Branch. Did you think that was home at the time?
You know, it was home at the time, and we had tremendous support from County Parks and a guy by the name of Gary McLaughlin and later Bob Girasi and John Cooley. And Mark Gummer had become an instrumental part of Jazz Fest at this point. He's been our production guy, stage guy, sound guy for the last 35 years. But at this point, he really helped shape the festival and what it looked like. But the artists that we brought in, I thought it was a real mixed bag. No surprise. Michael Franks, Mahavishnu John McLaughlin with Jonas Hellborg. I mean, that was Sun Ra came in with the orchestra. Stanley Clark was there. I'll never forget Stanley Clark waiting out the rain and jumping off the stage, leaping into the air with his bass. I think we really took a major turn upward in 1989. That was the year we had Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah. That leads me to ask, was he the most iconic jazz figure to appear at Jazz Fest up to this point?
Well, certainly. And I think that's primarily because Dizzy's one of the most iconic jazz figures of all time. I mean, everybody in the world knows who Dizzy Gillespie is, you know. But, I mean, to see him play Night in Tunisia in Burke's Works, I mean, this was Dizzy, you know, in an African hat with his jiggle stick, which was made of Coke bottle caps, which he left behind, by the way. And Dizzy was the only guy that you could send the jiggle stick to Dizzy Gillespie, USA, and it would get to him in Fort Lee, New Jersey, right? His only address was Dizzy Gillespie, USA. That's how well-known Dizzy was.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a special moment for Jazz Fest. He was incredible, funny, great, had an incredible band, Ignacio Baroa, John Lee, you know, they were great, and it was great, and it was a moment.
And as big an artist as Dizzy Gillespie was, it was a small band or a small group, a little known group that actually took hold here at Jazz Fest for a few years run, the New York Voices. How did sort of they developed into an area favorite?
For a couple of reasons. One, I met them when they were students at Ithaca College, all majoring in vocal and instrumental jazz. They were all students, Darman Meter and Peter Eldridge and Kim Nazarian. So that's where they got their start. And Marty Ashby and Jay Ashby. And when I was doing the club events, this young guy, Marty Ashby, guitarist, who was from Syracuse, from Baldwinsville, his father was a guitar teacher, called me up and said, hey, listen, we got some great players down at IC. We want to come up and play. I think at that time they were called Aurora. And Aurora later became the New York Voices. So we had a relationship with them in college. And they were at the Jazz Fest last year doing a salute to Mark Murphy. So that's another group we've had an almost 40-year relationship with.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to see how a community will embrace its own. Did you still see that when we have regional and local folks who are from the Central New York area performing at Jazz Fest, that the community really embraces them?
Yeah, the New York Voices, Joe, I think are, you know, they're fan faves. There's something really unique and special about their connection to the market. People absolutely love them here. There's a relatable there. People feel like, hey, these are our own, you know, artists. Mm-hmm. And they really embrace them and they love them, and that love affair has continued. I mean, one year we had them headline the festival backed by the Count Basie Orchestra, which was incredible, with Grover Mitchell leading the band. The local artists here that have performed at Jazz Fest, they've been student artists, they've been resident-based artists, they've been national artists who have returned to Syracuse, they've been artists who have based in Syracuse and made their way on the national and international stage, people like Nancy Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
They have been received extremely well at Jazz Fest, yes. People really love their own, their certain hometown pride. It's kind of like what I call the Dewan Coleman syndrome.
You mentioned Jazz Fest was not free at this time. Did you think that business model was sustainable at the time?
No, it wasn't free, but it was near free. My God, it was $10. I think people pay double that for parking for a basketball game these days. So it the cost was nominal. We were just trying to take in enough money from those 3,000 people that attended to cover our expenses. It was sustainable in the sense that we didn't lose money. Mm-hmm. We broke even, which is pretty much what we're still doing today.
And there were just a ton of fantastic performers during this period. We mentioned Dizzy, The Voices, Chick Corea, Tuck and Patty, Dr. John, Stanley Clark, Michael Franks, and so many others. Managing the logistics of a festival is one thing. Managing artists is another. Who were some of the problem children that you had? And don't give me any crap about everybody is professional and everybody is nice. You had to have had some knuckleheads.
I have to tell you, I know you're going to think I'm hedging and being diplomatic. I'm not. Artists don't exist at this level for this long and stay out there doing what they're doing without some sort of spiritual connection to the human family and to the music. They're all really special people. Like, I met Dr. John at the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival when he was there doing the gree-gree stuff in the costume, in his Night Tripper persona, but he was also playing guitar as backup for Bobby Blue Bland. So we got to hang out in 1972. We got to meet. So by the time these artists come to the festival, they know me. They've seen me in New York or at a festival. They've met me before. So there's a comfort level. And they come in. They know that we're an artist first festival. So we go out of our way with our production team and our artist relations team to make them comfortable, because the theory behind that, the underlying philosophy is we're there to serve the music and the people who make the music for the people who enjoy the music. So if we take good care of people backstage, they're going to go out and give the best set they're capable of on any given day. One time, I will tell you, when we moved downtown, we did have an issue with one artist, but the artist was so great and the people that were with him were so great that we gave him a pass. You know, he was kind of off his meds and his wife didn't make the trip with him and he was having a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Jimmy Smith.
Oh, wow.
And when you're talking about the greatest B3 player of all time and another iconic jazz legend, you know, he was also playing with Herlin Reilly on drums and Phil Upchurch on guitar, so that didn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not having his best day, and he got up and dissed somebody from the microphone, and I cringed a little bit, and I thought, well, hey, this is live. It's happening real.
This is Jazz Fest 35, Chronicles of the 35-Year History of the Syracuse Jazz Fest. I'm Joe Lee, along with Jazz Fest founding director Frank Malfitano. And next time on Jazz Fest 35, it's the years 1991 through 95, the downtown years.
immediately the festival expanded. We had an opportunity to bring in more acts. We had more money. We had bigger attendance. It became a huge event in its first year downtown. And that's really, I think, the beginning of the modern era for Jazz Fest.
Jazz Fest 35 podcast is produced by Kevin Kloss with music direction from Eric Cohen. You can get all the episodes of this limited run series at WAER.org.